And then we figured it out. We essentially the Holy Grail. We figured out how to go into a city and fully take it over, drop in a store, and then just siphon and suck all of the sales from all of the other retailers in the region.
Welcome to the AZ Tech Podcast. I'm your host, Hamid Chojai, a tech enthusiast and entrepreneur. Recently, my wife and I sold our software companies and we're investing $10 million in Arizona's tech ecosystem. As a way to know what's happening in Arizona, every week, I get to sit down with some exceptionally talented people who are doing some cool shit. All right, let's go. I'm here with JT Marino, co-founder of Tuft & Needle, the mattress company that quite literally blew up the industry and eventually merged with the largest mattress company, Serta Simmons. Hey, JT, how are you?
Hi, great.
Great to have you here. Holy cow, Tuft & Needle has been like an incredible Phoenix success story. You and your co-founder built something basically out of scratch and built it organically and profitably and became a multi-hundred million dollar revenue company before you guys merged. And that was like in a matter of like 6 years-ish, 6 year time frame, which is like insane timeline. So I want to ask you about that and I want to get to know JT, the person. So let's start with Tuft & Needle, and I know your story is pretty well known, but let's touch on the story of how you guys founded it, and then we'll get into some good juicy stuff after that. So feel free to start wherever you like.
Let's see. So, well, it's always interesting thinking about it, and also when I tell the story that I'm in the mattress industry, my background's technology, it seems really strange, but if you've going back to the story and how we originated the concept, it makes sense. So, my background, computer science, mathematics, I ended up in Silicon Valley and helped several companies build their technology stacks and their products and their engineering and design teams. My co-founder, Dahi Park, is a really good friend of mine. We met in college, also background in technology. We were at a startup just before Tuft & Needle in Palo Alto. And we just got to a point where we felt that we had learned enough about what makes a good company and how to build a company, not just product, but a little bit on the operations side. And we decided that it was just time to start something. And since college, we had always talked about maybe doing something together.
Right.
So I remember it vividly. I had made the decision myself, and I went on a walk I usually would go to the Willows Market in Palo Alto. And Dahi was along on that walk, and I was trying to figure out how I was going to break it to him that I'm going to leave the company we were at. And I basically told him that I was planning to leave, and he cut me off and said, "I am too." and I said, "Well, I really want to take a shot at starting my own company rather than, you know, we've never done it before. I've never done that before, and I've helped so many startups get going, and I wanted to take a shot of my own." And he's like, "I'm down. Let's do it." So we spent on the walk back from the Willows Market. We had discussed that we didn't want to force a concept or an idea. And based on, you know, a lot of what I have learned, that some of the greatest companies really were started or born out of an experiential problem that the founders had, or someone that they knew. And so we had discussed this idea of taking this approach of starting first and evaluating what poor experiences we've had, not really knowing necessarily what, you know, market it would be, but just like what are things in our life, whether professional or, you know, outside of work, that's been painful. So that's how we framed up some guidelines. So it started with, first, we're going to identify a problem.
Something that's been painful as the problem. Let me actually have you pause there for just a moment, because what were you guys doing in Silicon Valley? Where did you grow up? Like, had you grown up in Phoenix before?
We actually both grew up in Pennsylvania.
Okay.
Yeah, so I grew up in the Bethlehem area, which is the east side of Pennsylvania.
And you went to Penn State?
Yep.
So what took you to Silicon Valley? Was it the job in a software company? Or?
So my last year of school, I actually had a job offer. I had a company reach out, a big Silicon Valley company reach out, who saw some of the programs I had been like building and launching online.
Okay.
And I was literally in my last semester of college, and I took the call, I entertained it, and it ended up with an offer. And so my perspective was, if I'm able to get an offer without having to graduate, like, let's jump on this. So,
And did he landed at the same company?
No. Okay. So he went, he took a different path. So there's a gap between, college and Tuft & Needle of a few years, where I had worked at several, I worked at a software consultancy, at the time was one of the top software consultancies in the world.
Gotcha.
And from there that exposed me to, a new approach that was, well, new to me, an approach of building software and building products. Very rapidly launching them and building teams. And then I took that experience and then joined us and helped several startups build their products in Silicon Valley.
Gotcha. Yeah. So you'd already built your career as a software guy working in the industry.
Software design and product development.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Now you're writing your sort of guidelines of the next company that you want to build. And, you know, as a software guy, you're thinking that's probably going to be software, right? Or is that like...
Right.
Okay.
You would think.
Okay.
So as we're going down, like if we were going to make... So I've learned that it's easier to make decisions when you have constraints. And so that was our goal here, was like to let's put some constraints on whatever the problem was, if we were going to select a problem, and also put some constraints on how we would approach building the actual business.
Yeah.
So the first one was, it must be a problem that we've experienced. The second was, we wanted no outside capital at all. We wanted to bootstrap it.
Why was that important?
Well, there's just so many examples where you see companies that are prioritizing growth over everything. And we just didn't want to build a company like that. And we wanted to have freedom of our destiny and choice of our own path. So if we were just thinking out loud, like if we were going to build a company, if we didn't want to go and be the number one in the market, or if we wanted to build a small boutique that really has a moat around a particular niche or something like that, we just wanted the freedom to build and run a business our way. And so we felt that if we were to raise capital, we were going to lose that ability.
Yeah. You can't write the story the way you want to, because it becomes about returns for the investors.
Yeah. And not to say that raising capital is bad, and there's many companies that you really do need that are very capital intensive to start. But that was a constraint that wasn't really important to us. I've also seen a lot of the cons and the downside of capital, where I've seen examples where the founding team and the greater team don't necessarily have the fire under their ass to actually build a product that customers love, and instead focus on the marketing side of things and buying their customers to really get started. And that's not the type of – we were very product focused, not so much marketing focused when we started.
Gotcha.
So yeah.
I'm sorry. Continue the story from – okay, you wrote down the constraints and –
Yeah, constraints. So we didn't want to be limited by software. So I personally was very burnt out on building the next hot app or attempting to. And I was just ready for something new and different. That's just my personality. And it's also the same thing we were talking about hobbies earlier. Same thing with hobbies and everything else. So that was another example. We wanted a culture. We wanted to build a culture we could work for and retire with, like work for the rest of our lives and just love being in the office and being with the team. And we also didn't want to have a predefined exit strategy. So I would say two more things was, we wanted to, at a very minimum, success would be measured by financial independence for us as co-founders. Even if it was just the two of us, the ability to not have to get a job, so that this would support our, you know, very, I would say, lean lifestyles at the time. but we also wanted to go for something big and potentially disrupt an industry if we could.
Very cool.
Yeah.
All right. So now you got the criterias down and mattresses. How did that come about?
So we both decided to put together our own list. So we're doing retrospectives on our lives. So it took a few weeks. And we just wrote down, it was a little difficult for me at first, but by the second week I started like writing down things that were just a pain in my ass. And one of them on our list was mine, shopping for a mattress. And it was like one of these ideas that it pops in your head and you're like, we're not going to do it, but I'm just going to write it down anyway. And that made the list. And so when we sat down together and we started running through all the problems we experienced, in a weird way, this like the least sexy item on the list, the one that seemed the most boring and the most archaic, would probably be the least fun, was one that we kept laughing about and going back to and talking about it. And it was, I wouldn't say traumatic, but I had a very emotional experience when I bought my first mattress. And Dahi also had a similar experience. So that was something we both really also related to, as far as the shopping experience. But it's not just the shopping journey. It's also the product itself. So that was essentially how we honed in on that particular idea. But we actually had five.
Yeah, I want to hear about the other ones as well. But before you tell them, it is kind of crazy the way you bought mattresses before, is that like you had to go to stores, mm-hmm. and it was actually very much car dealership, you know, very similar to the car dealership model of like buying a mattress. And it's like they have salespeople who are trying to like sell you a mattress.
it's exactly
right. Like, which one are, you know, what if I can make you a deal on this one today? Will you go home with it? I mean, like a crazy industry. Why was mattresses in particular sold that way before you guys disrupted it?
I think it was just the nature of how that market had developed organically in the beginning. So there were traditionally and still primarily the market is still run by the manufacturing, the brands who are manufacturers, and they sell to retailers. And there's this disconnect between the brands and the customer. And so, and as we learned, I was still very new to business and starting Tough the Needle. We were both learning on the job.
Yeah.
But I've always...
Learning on the job, by the way, is where the best disruptions happen, because you guys don't know what not to do. So you do all kinds of stuff that you're not supposed to do. And it turns out some of those things turn out to be sort of like game changers, right?
Exactly. Like the student's mindset and just the naive mind. Exactly. And that definitely did play into how we approached our company. So there's a few decisions that we made that was definitely driven by this naive mindset. I'm just more experienced with companies that build a product and then launch it direct to their customer. And then they listen to their customer's feedback and they iterate. So software, you can make tweaks and changes to your products all day long.
Right.
And then as we got into the mattress industry and learned about the supply chain and manufacturers and retailers, there wasn't this feedback loop. So it was missing. So in a sense, I would even say that the manufacturing companies, which are most of the big brands that people know, don't actually have a direct feedback to their customers. So they're not really iterating their product based off of what like the customer is saying. And to me, that was bizarre.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How crazy.
Yeah.
So they basically put out a mattress and then like 3 years later, they might like have a new version of the mattress, something to that effect.
I love this idea to use an example like Porsche. You see a Porsche 911 and it's iterating and improving over time.
Right.
And that's how I view software products typically are built, is that it's improving over time. And the approach that the mattress industry typically takes is a company will just, they'll make a mattress and the next season, they'll make another mattress with a different name to create new flash and to create, newness in the marketplace, as opposed to really focusing on the different types of sleepers and different types of needs that sleepers have, and then iterating on those models.
Yeah.
So that's the way I would have approached it. And that's the way we did end up approaching it with Tough the Needle. But that's not typically how it was done.
So you had this bad experience. How did you guys decide that, okay, this is the industry we're going to go after?
So because we weren't raising capital,
you
hear entrepreneurs talk about their runway, how much money that they have before, to sustain their operations before they run out.
Yeah.
So one thing that's really unique and different about Tough the Needle is we decided not to raise capital. So we were purely operating based off of our savings, which was not a lot. So we had, I would say, roughly 6 to 7 months, each of us, in savings. And we cut all of our expenses. I started eating ramen noodles. And my wife took up a second job. And Dahi did something similar. So anyways, by the nature of having a short window that we had to figure something out, we didn't have the time to build a presentation and then pitch it and find like if we were going to have another co-founder or whoever, and then pitch it to an investor, raise capital, hire people, build it out, launch it. And we didn't have time for a year or a year and a half to get something out of the door. So what we knew we needed to do was to very rapidly test all of our different concepts so that we could get an indication or validation that we were onto something.
Right.
So when it came to Tough the Needle, what we did was the framework we used, we call it the hate list, where we took a legal pad of paper, wrote the hate list at the top, and just wrote down. So we have this problem of shopping for a mattress. So we have this problem with the product. And so let's articulate that specifically. So we started writing down all of the things that were painful about shopping for mattresses. I had some, he had some. And then what do we not like about mattresses, just in general, the product? And we wrote those down. And so as an example, you have to go to a store, or you have to haggle with a commission salesperson, or there's too many options, or I don't know what firmness I want, or, you know, mattresses start sagging after you sleep on them for a few years, like things like that. Line down the center, and then we would just write sort of the antithesis of each of the, or how we would approach. If we could wave a magic wand, how would we solve each of those things, which really isn't rocket science.
Yeah.
So we wrote down all of the features that we would need to have as a full company, from the product to the experience, that would address the majority of these issues. From there, we reduced that list to the least and easiest amount of them that we believed would be enough to, one, convince somebody to buy a mattress sight unseen, and two, to buy a mattress from a brand they've never heard of. And so we took that short list, and then we converted it into a sales page, a website, a single page website. We purchased a photo stock image of a mattress at the top, and this was just like a throwaway. This is the way we validated the whole. This whole exercise took about 4 or 5 days, and then at the bottom we had a credit card form that would authorize but not capture. So we wanted a stranger to type in their credit card information and hit to purchase, but it wouldn't actually process, so that we would then get a signal that a stranger just attempted to buy. So anyway, we built this site. I would also just like, for context, and I think this is something that is unique to the partnership with my co-founder, between the two of us, we were able to really build the majority of the test and also the initial founding and products of the company. So we had complementing skill sets. So that was very helpful.
Wait, when you say founding of the product of the company, what do you mean? Like, you guys had never built mattresses, right? Like, do you mean just a website, or?
So, yes. So, like, developing the website and the design, being able to understand and start some early marketing, performance marketing.
So everything but the product itself.
And then the product, when it came to the product, that was one of my tasks. And so I just approached it the way I would have if it was software.
Okay.
So that was definitely, there was a lot of learning going from software to a tangible good.
Yeah.
And how to approach that and figure out supply chain, because I've never really worked with a formal supply chain before. Definitely frustrating and definitely a trial in and of itself. But essentially that's as far as like our skill sets and how we.
So you put up this test webpage. You don't have a product yet. You can take credit cards, and you're hoping that like the test will show that like somebody wants a mattress and is willing to pay for it online, because at that time online, like, mattresses weren't sold online yet, right?
Well, mattresses were actually sold online since the late 90s.
Okay.
So what was really unique about ours was we had one mattress, which was very counterintuitive and very much like against the grain of what everybody understood about mattresses, like different firmnesses and people have different preferences. And we had this hypothesis, back to the naive mindset. So if we were being coached by somebody from the industry, they would say, this doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Even the
you're not going to create one mattress for
right.
everyone.
And even our contract manufacturers, like, this is nonsense. It's not going to work. But go ahead and try it if you want. So one was, we wanted a product that it was a mattress that was just one that would, is the 80-20, would work for most people. So that was one. undercutting the competition by going around the margins of retail, not doing discounts, having free returns, having like a real warranty. So it wasn't necessarily one thing. It was the sum of all of these features that was really unique.
So these features, just to be clear, were non-existent. This is just sort of like your wish list of things that you wanted to have if you were going to go create a mattress company.
Right. So
as a potential consumer of it.
I would say there were various companies that had some of these features.
Right.
Like maybe one.
No. I meant non-existent for the company that you guys were testing, right? Because in four days you hadn't built anything, right?
it was no product. It was a facade. It was just a website basically articulating what the product and service and everything
would
is.
Be if it existed.
If you looked at the website, it looked like a real product company.
Okay.
It was a farce.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
But you were like essentially saying, these things that you're saying, that like the mattress is firm and, blah, blah, blah.
Right, yeah. Exactly. So we put this website up. I'm sitting in like this well-known cafe in Palo Alto, Coupa Cafe, which is always very busy. They have no outlets, so they can cycle people out. But I mean, this is a cafe that very famous founders kind of like started working at. So I'm sitting in if you're looking at the cafe in the right window, right at that window, I'm sitting there at a small table. It's like 8 o'clock at night. It's totally buzzing. There's a long line at the cash register, and I deploy the website, and Dehi wasn't with me, but I sent him a text and said, okay, the site's up. I got a text right back, and he said, okay, the ad is up. So he took out an ad online, and I just went back to work, and I would say about 15 minutes later, my phone was ringing, and it was Dehi, and I answered the phone, and he's like screaming, and I can't understand what he's saying, and I'm like, dude, like calm down, like what are you saying? He's like, we just made a sale. And I literally jumped out of my seat, which I've never done anything like this before, but I literally jumped out of my seat so fast that the back of my knees like slid my chair behind me. And I yelled like really loud, jackpot, super loud. And I like froze. This is very not in my character. And I was frozen, and I looked around the room, and everyone like, it's like the cafe went on pause, and everyone was staring at me. And there was a couple people that were just like nodding and smiling as if they knew what had just happened. But anyways, that was our validation. So that was enough for us to say, now we need to explore how we're going to actually start this. And, if it was that easy to have instigate a sale for a customer, if the problem's that bad, that we're definitely on to something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So you set out to build a mattress company right then and there. Like I presume that was the moment where you guys knew this is the company that you want to build.
So we continued building. Like I mentioned, there were five other concepts.
Okay.
So we continued building a couple others that were pretty confident.
What were some of the others?
I'll tell you two of them. So one was a B2B software product,
okay,
which still has not been actually built yet. Nobody's actually really built this product, but it was a form of collecting data across all channels that a typical retailer or a multi-channel retailer would have, and then aggregating that into like now you would say more machine learning or AI, but essentially a decision tree so that you can start building profiles of your customers anonymously. We're very big, especially Dehi and the privacy. So this is a product that we actually built a pitch. So our test here was that we built a pitch deck and we were pitching it to Macy's. And what we were told was they wanted to do a 4-month test before they made a decision if they were going to actually purchase the product. So we didn't build the product. So this is another example in how a B2B, a business-to-business product concept that was stemmed in a problem that we had had in the past of really understanding our customers in a more, I would say, qualitative way didn't exist. And so we built out the designs and we built out a pitch deck. So that was one. Another one was, I would say it's, so it was a... it was a website that you could build out your supplement stack. We called it. It was called the project name.
Vitamins.
Vitamins. Okay. So it was a vitamin stack. So you build a vitamin stack, and then you could share it. And it actually went viral. So the concept went viral. We seeded it for feedback on Reddit, but it was really quickly picked up by athletes and bodybuilders and few other small segments of people. So this actually was going viral. We had a lot of work to do to figure out how we would actually execute on developing custom supplement stacks that we would ship you. Later, you hear about a company called PillPack, which is very similar. And I don't know if we had any influence on that, but that was another concept. That one, I would say, actually had the biggest takeoff as far as user adoption. But it was literally of the concept website, not of the. It wasn't like, you know, that was the validation. It wasn't so much like we hadn't built the actual company yet. But that was another concept that we had.
How come you abandoned that one?
We abandoned it because we felt that we were going to need. It was going to be capital intensive, purchasing supplements and then stocking. We'd need some kind of like. Stocking like warehouse and like co-packing involved and
because you had to do custom development of the pack is that why is like yes. the idea was like custom supplements essentially or
exactly so you would choose like the different supplements and nutraceuticals that you know you're taking so instead of having like a cabinet full of tons of bottles
yeah. It's a great idea still, actually, I feel like. So,
I still, it takes me probably 30 minutes to build like my pill capsules. Like for I do 2 weeks at a time and I have a cabinet and there's probably 30 bottles in it that I have to go through. But that was a concept. And we just felt that the effort to launch was it may be a bigger company and potentially higher value because of the size of that market. But because of our constraints, we had to eliminate it. So,
gotcha.
So, yeah.
All right. So what a fantastic way, by the way, to like, this is like a perfect execution on the sort of lean startup model that became very popular much later on, I think. Mm-hmm. But what a great execution of that. Now you're down to like knowing what product category you want to go after. How do you build a company around mattresses where you know nothing about? Right? Like you knew nothing about mattresses. You're a software guy. Your mm-hmm. co-founder is a software guy. where do you start? Like,
well, it was now in hindsight, I would say it was easy. But okay. In the moment, it was very difficult. Like I didn't know anything about mattresses. We didn't even know if they're who are the manufacturers? What is the manufacturing process?
Right.
Are the manufacturers the brands? Are there any contract manufacturers who could make a product like this for us? So we had a lot of unknowns, and that was a bit of a risk because we didn't know if we could even do this. If all the brands had their own manufacturing, if there was no contract manufacturer, then we'd have to learn how to manufacture, and that would have likely eliminated itself from our list of ideas, of concepts. So how it started was the product, the mattress I bought, my first one, I spent $3,500 on. And I really hated it, so it didn't really pain me to take a saw and saw it open. So I sawed off, like, my wife Sarah is like, what are you doing? I'm like literally sawing the corner off of our mattress in our bedroom. This is even before, like, we were totally dead set that this was going to be what we were going to do. But I cut off, like, a corner of it and just to see what's inside.
You're like, don't worry, I can duct tape.
Yeah, and then just writing down like what the different materials that I was looking at, and even some of these materials I've never seen before, like the fabrics they use. It's not like it's not like a knit that's typically shirts or like a woven that's typically like jeans. It's not a fabric that I'm accustomed to, so I didn't know what it was. There was another fabric, which is later I learned was the fire retardant, and then different foams, and so. From there, I found like a trade, like a conference that all the suppliers go to. And in there were was the list of all the companies. And so from there, I was able to then find phone numbers and I started making phone calls. So I called, and I'll be perfectly honest, and this is not something I necessarily feel good about, but I actually wasn't able to get anybody to take my call until I had to tell a white lie. So when I would call a salesperson at a supplier and I said, I'm thinking about starting a mattress company, it was like, click, it's not interested. It was definitely, right. At that time, it was a very closed industry to newcomers and very incestuous. So a lot of people that are at different companies, suppliers, or brands have worked at many others. So it's just this tight-knit, small community, sort of like a good old boys sort of club. And it wasn't until I would tell them that I was a retailer in Phoenix and I had about 10 stores before they're like, that was enough for them to justify taking a call. And so from there, I found a salesperson at one that would make one specific component of the mattress. And I'm very thankful for him because he answered all my questions. So I asked him, like, what is this material? What is that? And he fully educated me on what each of those materials, like the fabric is called ticking. And that fabric that's under the ticking is a fire sock. That's what they call it. Huh. And then the different materials, like there's memory foam, and then there's like standard polyurethane foam, and then there's latex foam. There's all these different components. And then from there, I was able to say, okay, well, who makes these things? Are there any manufacturers who can make the actual product? And so he helped me essentially build the map or the offline social network of all of these different brands because they didn't really have websites then. And from there, I was able to start calling suppliers and then found contract manufacturers. And then we found a small mom and pop shop that makes furniture components who wanted to get into mattresses. But it was a long process. It took about 3.5 months or so. I rented a car and drove up and down the East Coast and the West Coast, just driving to the manufacturing facilities. And wow. In some cases, like, it's so strange. You walk up and the front door would be locked. It's like in an industrial parks. They're all in industrial parks. And there was even cases where I would go around the back where the trucks were loading up in the bay, and I'd jump up into the bay and just walk in to the manufacturing floor and just ask around till I found the salesperson.
Wow.
And then, you know, I'm there. I'm talking right. to them, and so they'd sit down with me. And so that's really the approach that, you know, we had to take as an outsider coming in. So we're sort of like an alien in this industry. And trying to figure out how it all works.
What determination? And at this point, you still have no idea if this is going to work. You're just trying to build out the product.
Right.
So how long did that whole process take? Was it just 3-4 months? Or?
Well, and I would also say that the more that we learned about how the industry worked, the more passion we had.
Mm. You're getting convinced now that wow, this is so backwards.
Yeah,
the way it
was
works.
Really bad. And the way that how materials are selected and the margins and the markups and how many different layers there are in the supply chain was just mind blowing. And we could not believe how many hands these products go through before it ends up into a consumer's hands.
Yeah.
And the lack of empathy and communication, surveying, reviews with customers and feeding that back in, because the people who design and make these products are not even in contact with the customer. So how do they even know what to do next with their product? So it's so strange. So that test, when I was in Coupa Cafe and we had that sale, or mock sale, that was in June of 2012. October of 2012 is when we officially launched Tufted Needle, and that's fully bootstrapped. So we went through the summer 2012, launched, and it was about 3 months to the point where we were selling enough product that we were able to sustain our very lean lifestyles.
It's 3 months after you launched it in October.
Right.
Okay. So, from June to October, you're figuring out how to build the product, and then you relaunched the website.
Exactly.
With an actual product this time. How long before the first sale the second time around? Did that take more
than
3 days? Were you guys nervous?
Not 15 minutes.
Yeah. You're like, oh shit, maybe that was a fluke, or like.
Very, very, very nervous. And because it wasn't so much that we wouldn't make a sale. It was more so, could we be profitable?
Yeah.
And then also, could we sell enough that we could sustain the two of us and our bills that we had to pay? Because we went from college to a professional careers for a few years. And every time I moved to a new city, I'd use my savings to essentially execute those moves. And so, I mean, everything of mine was in this business.
Considering how quickly you got the first sale when it was a mock website versus an actual website taking 3 days, tell me how you guys felt during those 3 days where a sale hadn't come through yet.
Well, I mean, it was fire in the belly. We were so stoked on launching and figured it's going to be in 15 minutes. It's going to be in 5 minutes because the site's so good and the photography
way better.
we didn't have the capital for photography, so we found this like 3D animator who does high fidelity renderings to do like a mock image of our product, how it looked. So like, yeah, it looked great, and we launched it, and I wasn't really nervous until the next morning after we launched. Still no sales, and I'm like, Dahi, are the ads like they like the
are
same?
They working?
Are they yeah they're working? and then by the third day we did make a sale, and then and that was really by the end of the year we were averaging it in December enough, and it was just profitable enough that we were able to pay ourselves the bare minimum to be ramen profitable.
Right.
Yeah.
How long did it take for you guys to have $1 million in sales?
$1 million in sales was 2013. So
all of 2013.
All of 2013.
So basically your first full year of operations, you had $1 million in sales.
Yes.
At what point did you know that, okay, like now it's just a scale moment? And like, what made you still convinced that this should be an organically grown company as opposed to, okay, now we've had $1 million in sales, we should go, like, we could, you know, 10x this or 100x this if we could go raise some money and build out?
End of 2013, I would say. Yeah, because what happened was, and we called it the pit of sorrow. Some people refer to this phase. Some companies go through this phase where you start and you have, like, this initial excitement and a bump of traction. And then you either like your sales dip and fall, and you're in this length of time where you're not sure if it's going to work, or they just sort of stagnate. And so for us, we were having over the course of 2013, we'd have days where we'd sell three, we'd have a day where we sell 10, we'd have 3 days in a row with zero. Really, in hindsight, you know, it all starts to make sense. I see that there was seasonality that we didn't understand. There were sales periods where competitors or other companies were going on sale. So that was also impacting us. And also, we couldn't see the area under the graph of our actual growth. It wasn't until we actually grew a little more where we could actually see and have an idea of measure of like what the volume really is, because we were seeing just the top of the growth graph.
Right.
So, but what we did in 2013, because we're bootstrapped, we're definitely cash poor.
Right.
So we started with, there was $6,000. I put $3,000, he put $3,000 in to open up our business account, because there's like minimums to open up accounts. And you need an account so you can make payments and do a credit card and all that. But so we were really cash poor. So we didn't have a lot of resources to actually drive marketing. So we really needed to rely on those early customers to spread the word. And we did a little bit of guerrilla marketing on the side and with our free time. We had a lot of free time the first year, a lot of free time.
Yeah.
There just wasn't enough work to go around for the two of us because we couldn't really spend. And then the volume of people we were getting was just really sort of easy to keep up with. So I spent a lot of time developing our websites, building software infrastructure, which in hindsight, again, I'm very grateful for. But I would recommend to entrepreneurs not to waste your time on building software if that's not your core competency and that's not specifically your product. But I had this idea that we would automate in the future. So I spent a lot of time on the software, on the supply chain, that he was really focusing on the marketing and legal, finance, and customer service. We had this deal where Dahi would field the calls, and then I would handle the really upset customers because he just didn't want to do that. So I would focus more on like the product and the tech stack. But so what happened was by the end of 2013, and also a note, we hired our brothers. So my brother, Tyler, and his brother, Gunny, worked for us for free for a few months. So we didn't have to actually pay them. But we eventually, like, paid them. Tyler, my brother, is still at the company. And Gunny moved on to start his own. But, so that's, like, another little side note. Like, when you bootstrap, you just have to be really scrappy and find some interesting ways. Our office was actually a transmission shop.
Oh, my gosh.
Like an auto mechanic transmission shop.
You guys are trying to sell mattresses through
Well, we're online, so we just needed a space
that was,
you know, had some quiet with like good internet, but at the same time. We had like, we would be on a phone call and you'd hear like the air compressor go, or they'd have like their air powered wrenches, like putting their tires on. Exactly. So they built this like front office space that was like just a spare room. And that's like what we rented. It was so cheap. But anyways, that was our first like official, you know, sublease that we had.
So you didn't stock any inventory. did somebody else ship it for you, or like make it and ship it for you? Or?
Our contract manufacturer did.
Okay,
so gotcha. The idea, what we wanted was, we really wanted to manufacture our own product, but that was just too much.
Yeah, to take on in year one.
Exactly. And so we were taking the approach of, let's design the product and iterate on it. And we have that expectation and that relationship with the manufacturer. And that's what we did. And having one product makes that really simple and much easier to do. And also having not a massive customer base like we do now, it was a lot easier to make changes weekly and or monthly as we were getting customer feedback. But to answer your question, where we knew it was going to take. So in the summer of 2013, we had this idea to put our mattress on Amazon. And we did see some mattresses there, but it didn't really seem like people were buying mattresses at Amazon.
Right.
And we've been like praised for the brilliance of like putting our product on Amazon and using that to essentially help fund our growth. But I wouldn't give us that much credit, because the reason we went to Amazon was to have a place that we could send our customers to write reviews.
Reviews, yeah.
Yeah, it was that credibility. It ended up becoming, by accident, a huge market. Yeah. So it ended up growing massively, and it helped our growth and exposure for our brand. But what we did was, in November of 2013, we wrote an article. It was a show HN or show Hacker News. So on Hacker News, we wrote this article that said how, and you can find this, how we bootstrapped Tuft & Needle to the number one mattress on Amazon. And that post blew up. It blew up so huge that it held like the top spot on Hacker News for almost 4 days.
Wow.
And as a byproduct of posting that, we started getting all of these people reaching out, asking questions. That's when a venture capitalist in New York found us, which then led to like most of the blue chip venture capitalists had at some point then reached out to see if we were, they realized this is a startup and it's in the mattress industry. Wait, we haven't been thinking about the mattress industry.
Or any other industry for that matter, other than software right at the time.
And then the VCs were like deciding this was a space they wanted to play in, and this is the first startup who's done it. So we started getting reach outs, and then we had this this author and editor from Fortune magazine reach out, and that was our first PR lead.
Nice.
Which turned into our first interview. And then he published an article that said, meet the Warby Parker of mattresses, Tuft & Needle. I didn't even know about Warby Parker at the time. So I'm just like, I'm a techie, and you know, I'm not so much at the time in the fashion and what became a huge trend of D2C, building a D2C company. I just was very naive to all of that. But that, and through that article and through all of this exposure in Hacker News, we saw this flood of orders come in. And it didn't ever stop from that point.
Wow.
Because we had so much downtime and I wasn't working, I didn't need to work that often, and neither did Dahi. We had all this extra time in 2013 to really sort of polish, you know, I'm not a fan of polishing your tools, but we polished our tools. We spent a lot of time on iterating on the product. Even though we didn't have a lot of customers, we still did iterate on our product, collect customer feedback. I called every single customer in 2013. Every customer got a phone call from me or at least an email. And then that turned into an automated Net Promoter Score system.
Wow.
But anyway, so we were ready to scale. And it's sort of that idea that preparedness meeting opportunity. And that's really what happened. So we were very prepared to scale. We just didn't have the volume. And then when that article hit, it was just like, boom. And in 2014, we hit 9 million. 2015, it was 40 million. And then it was 90 million. Then it was 150. And then we got to a 250 million a year run rate, annual revenue run rate, before we did the merger with Serta Simmons. So, I mean, it was not to say we didn't have problems or sometimes that it was slower growth, but we were having a very consistent, incredible growth trajectory, like a fast, like a hockey stick, typical high funded startup. We just didn't raise any capital. We only had 2 months, and it was near, sort of closer to the time that we did the merger, where we actually weren't profitable. We were profitable every other month. all the way up until and still are very profitable.
That's amazing. What an incredible story. Now, when these VCs were coming to you and you were saying no, is that what sparked Casper and, you know, like some of the other sort of like, is it Purple or whatever, like copycats that they ended up funding? Because I know those guys raised a bunch of money, right?
Yes. So Casper was our first official competitor. And they started, I want to say in June. It was summertime of 2014. I met them, you know, when they were working on their supply. I actually bumped into them before they had even launched their company at a conference. And we had a couple advisors, four Equitable advisors, who were tapped into to Silicon Valley and the New York like fundraising and finance world, and were hearing mumblings of like a funded startup to take on Tufted Needle, and which really lit a fire under our ass.
Yeah,
because we
can imagine
we hadn't really learned a lot about brand. We hadn't learned a lot about doing PR. We were just, our advisors were like, you have to figure these things out. You have to prepare yourself. Casper was first. And when Casper hit, it was, they had all this money. They raised a lot of money. They had a big seed raise. And then within a few months of launching, they had another raise. And then I want to say 6 months to a year later, another raise. They ended up raising, I want to say, over $500 million up to date. And then from there, what happened was how I was telling you with these suppliers, they didn't have websites, and it was very difficult to figure out how the mattress industry worked. Those barriers just faded away. So now anybody could sort of call in to a manufacturer and say, I have a startup, I'm starting, and they would like almost fight over your business because they have this example of Tufted Needle and they have this example of Casper, and only a few suppliers had like secured that business. And so you have all these other suppliers wanting to get on the action. So they're like removing their barriers and letting anybody in. So
right.
6 months after Casper was, I want to say 6 months, about 6 months was Lisa and Yoga Bed. And then I would say within 6 months after that was what, maybe about a year, we called the Gold Rush, where there was a rush of probably 200, somewhere around 200 other lookalike companies, some like grossly copying everything, like our ads and our copy, even design assets from our website.
Pricing, everything.
Everything was copied. Yeah. And so what we were trying to do was to, you know, with our mission as a business, we're trying to build essentially the world, like the United States, I don't know about other countries as much, first, truly customer first mattress company, more of a sleep company. And then part of that is like avoiding all the cognitive dissonance of decision making people go through when they're shopping for mattresses, building a joyful, easy shopping experience, a product that's badass and competes with the top of the line, most expensive mattresses on the market, but like undercuts everybody, and it's like the most economical mattress that you could buy. And that was sort of our approach. And so, you know, what happened was all these other spinoffs that were mimicking us created mass confusion again. So now people really had a difficult time understanding the difference between us and these other businesses. People would buy our product thinking it was a different company, or they'd buy another company thinking they bought a Tufted Needle because they had like multiple tabs open on their webs, on their browser.
Right.
And they're comparing and contrasting. Yeah.
They all look the same because they're trying to follow the leader. What's funny is that you guys did something truly special because your customers were incredible advocates for Tufted Needle. And the reason I know that is because the first time I heard that name was in 2015. Mm-hmm. And I was running Pure Chat, and our graphics designer was a huge Tufted Needle fan. She had just recently bought a Tufted Needle mattress. She literally got half the team at Pure Chat to buy Tufted Needle mattresses. And we're like, "What are they paying you? What the hell's going on?" And like, she couldn't stop talking about her Tufted Needle mattress. And we're like, you got to shut up already. Yeah. It's kind of crazy. So like, how did you guys build that incredible loyalty?
Yeah. And I would say that loyalty is something we still win on.
Yeah,
so our customers,
I believe it. But like, what did you do that was like so customer first that like caused your customers to be such advocates for Tufted Needle?
Well, and before I go into that, I would say this was a key component to our growth and how we are able to grow and how we are able to compete with highly funded startups. It had to do with the raving fans, which our customers are raving customers, yeah. still are. And we needed that in order to scale up. If we did not have that, we would not have survived the onslaught of all of our competitors. But the approach really is pretty simple. It's more difficult in execution and practicality. But it started with the phone calls. So we would call every single customer, and until that was difficult to scale, and ask them what they liked and what they didn't like. Obviously, people who did a return, we would talk to them. They'd call us, and we'd talk to them about it. But we would take all of the input that a customer would give us, and we always valued the negative, critical feedback more than the positive. And those issues then was funneled into our roadmap. So as an example, somebody might say they feel this ridge in the mattress. This was actually a problem around their ankle, and it was keeping them up at night. We didn't even think about that. So I went and looked at our product, and I noticed that there was a seam like about a foot away from the end of the bed. And so we figured out that we had to extend the fabric with extra panels to make it long enough to cover the mattress. So what we did, we figured out we could cut it in half and put half of it on one end, half it on the other, so the seam aligns with the edge. We had returns over this.
Wow.
And so we removed all those returns, and we no longer had that problem. We shipped the fixed product to that customer and said, thank you, we fixed it for everybody else too.
Yeah.
We took that approach not just with the product, and there's many things that we iterated on the product, but also with how we shipped. So we had a box that would show up like it looked like it was run over by a truck sometimes, and it was just not very durable and would get really grimy. So we ended up putting a protective coating on the laminate the print of the box, so it wouldn't get dirty. So when they bring it in their house, it doesn't get their carpet. It doesn't make their carpet black. Or the boxes that we get these big holes, we figured out how to reinforce the box. Working with the VP of engineering at FedEx so that their API could keep up with our orders. We were one of FedEx's largest customers. I would say not God tier like your Amazon, but not God tier aside, we're one of FedEx's largest customers in Phoenix. So we had their ear. And so we were able to help and work with their engineering team through their VP of engineering to make some iterations on their API so that we could automatically reroute packages so they would still make it to the customer. Like everything from how it ships, the box, the product, the packaging, the instructions, the website, everything, we viewed everything as a product. So to answer your question, the way we did that was iterating constantly and never being satisfied with it's sort of the sum of all things. There was no silver bullet. So even the pricing and how the warranty worked and what we did with returns when we picked them up, does it go to the landfill or did we build a database of all these donation sites and actually help them develop a method to take donations? Because there was only one company when we figured out how to do returns, which was is a story in of itself, our first return. But Vincent DePaul was the first nonprofit to say yes to taking a used mattress, and then they then took it and then cleaned it and then gave it to somebody in need. Then that scaled up, and now like you have Salvation Army doing it, and you have like all these small mom and pop sort of donation, you know, localized donation companies or nonprofits that now take mattresses. But that's another example of something that we iterated on. But it's really the sum of all things. I would also say the second part is our customer experience team is insanely good. It's better than Zappos. Zappos is always the bar. That's what I admired. On Delivery and Happiness, the book, and Tony Hsieh. And,
like, such a great book.
Huge inspiration for me and the team. And we just had this bar that we knew we had to exceed to blow away the experience that they would have somewhere else. But we never used any of our competitors as the bar. We always looked at companies outside of the mattress industry when we would compare our experience and our product.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So awesome. So you in 2018, you've built $250 million business organically. It's crazy big. It's growing. What drove you to do the merger, or like as the outsider saw it, like to sell to Serta Simmons, right? Like what was that decision like? Why'd you guys do it? Why then?
So what happened was, as we grew, And you had Casper and then all these others and then eventually Purple and all this money being spent on marketing online. We saw
they were all coming after you too, specifically.
I would say Purple less because they're a different price point, so they're more targeted after like your Tempur-Pedic sort of price level.
Okay,
but in a sense, we're in the same world. You know, I later learned not to view them as competitors. All these companies, they're really I viewed that we're collaborating more so, symbiotically building and creating awareness for a new way to buy a mattress. But as we were growing, we essentially tapped out the online market. So we did not even think about it. We just thought it would just grow forever. And we started to see our growth slowing down and sort of that S curve. We were starting to round or cusp that turn of growth. We started to look outward, like, how do we keep growing? And we had this like very long debate about the fact that when people are shopping for a mattress in particular, there's a large percentage of people that want to tactically feel it and see it before they buy it, whether we like it or not. And so we had to make a decision. Do we want to live in this world where about 15 to 20% of people are willing to buy a mattress online? Or do we want to explore moving into retail? Can we make those margins work? Maybe we don't have to raise the price and the volume would be enough to convince the retailer to sell it. Anyway, so that was one aspect. We wanted to keep growing. We decided we wanted to do it. So we had to find new places to sell our product. So that's one issue. The second is we, after we started exploring those other channels, it was very difficult as a small company that's not known to actually establish new relationships with retailers. Like imagine calling a big retailer and saying like, we're Tough the Needle and we want to sell in your store. And like how long it would take and how likely it is you go from A to Z. I mean, like we eventually figured it out. But, you know, we started with smaller retailers and then moved our way up. But so that was a challenge. So to counteract that issue of growth and adoption within other retail channels where we sell our product, we decided to explore opening up our own stores. So that was one real main reason was new channels, our own stores. The second issue was we were struggling. We figured out Google advertising. We struggled to really make Facebook advertising work. We see our competitors doing it, but we know that they are probably not profitable. And later, once they go public, we realize they're very much not profitable.
Right.
But we had to be. So we had to play the game differently. So just in the sense of advertising, we struggled to make the Facebook ads work profitably. We're very, very good advertisers, marketers. We're very, very tactical, and we measure everything. We have to because we're bootstrapped, and we don't have a war chest to fall back on if something goes wrong. YouTube was difficult, and other channels were very difficult. So we had this idea to, you know, maybe we can make out-of-home marketing work. And so you might have experienced this being in Arizona. We took about 2 years. We had this idea that if we could figure out how to make radio, television, and billboards and print work in conjunction with digital marketing that's hyper-localized, that we would have an edge and we'd be able to scale it up and that we would need that in order to open up stores and to accelerate our expansion of our stores and also with retailers.
Right.
So it took about 2 years, but we built a model so that we could understand how to measure and prove that. And also we have many different techniques that we iterated through to figure out actually how you go into a city and do a full takeover of the advertising. How do you do billboards, radio, television, and Google and YouTube and Facebook?
To get critical mass.
Yeah, to get critical mass profitably. It's very, very difficult to do. And it took us about 2 to 2.5 years to figure it out, but we did. And we figured it out so well that we could buy as many billboards as we wanted. We could ink deals with like huge talking heads and influencers, like radio show hosts and all of that. And we were doing that. And we literally had a playbook. We go into a city, we buy a certain amount of media, and then at the certain point we buy more. And then we spin up digital advertising, localized, so that when somebody drives on the highway to work, we made sure that they also saw an ad online. So we knew like commuters, and we put the billboards on highways to like like popular routes, and we were doing this across like all these other cities, and then we figured it out. We essentially the Holy Grail. We figured out how to go into a city and fully take it over, drop in a store, and then just siphon and suck all of the sales from all of the other retailers in the region. And in a sense, I'm proud of what we did, but also I feel guilty. But we many many retailers, mattress retailers, are going bankrupt when we would do this strategy, and we could sustain it. We could sustain it for, I mean, once we took over, we would ramp it down and we would pulse it back up, and we would just keep in the minds of the customers, because one of our goals was just to communicate that we're here. So that was the second reason. So what we did, or second thing that occurred. So you've got, we want to spin up stores. We figured out how to advertise out of home advertising blended with digital, which is something that many, many brands and other companies try to figure out how to do profitably. And but there is one catch. In order to go in and do a takeover and open up a store, it takes about 6 months to 9 months for us to see a return. And we're facing these like viciously competitive, highly funded startups that are doing something very similar, and they a lot of times in a lot of ways feel several steps ahead of us. And so we had to move quickly. So we figured out how to scale potentially to $1 billion plus company by opening up retail, and then which then we knew would segue into getting into, you know, retailers who we felt was aligned with customer experience. So we figured it out, but it was slow, and we could really only afford to do about two cities at a time. So we just back a napkin, figured out if we had about $25 million, we could do probably 10 stores, 5 to 10 stores at a time. And then over the course of a few years, we could scale that up. And our goal was to get to about 150 to 200 stores. And that would get us to $1 billion in sales. And we would be now a full-blown brand that's not just online, but has its own stores and is in retail stores that people shop at. And we're like this household name brand. This was our goal.
Yeah.
So we needed to raise capital. So every year, we actually did go on the road and talk to venture capitalists as an exercise. If the numbers were great, we might actually take the money. But we always struggled to find what we would use the money for, because we were always growing as fast as we could keep up with. So, and we always had enough money to do some experimentation. But when we figured out how to scale up out of home and going into brick and mortar, that was the point where we're like, we need money and we need to start moving faster. So the goal was raise $25 million. So we started sending out emails. And what happened was it like went viral outward from investors. So private equity found us, competitors found us, manufacturers, Chinese manufacturers. And so now we have this situation where, like, from their perspective, Tufted Needle finally is opening the door for financing and, right, and raising capital so I can get a piece of it. And we now have this perspective that we're now open to raising capital to sell a small percentage of our company, which we're 100% owned by Dehi and I and our employees. Excuse me. Now we're ending up with all these options.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, like, $25 million seems like not enough for where you guys were at. If you're over $100 million, $200 million in revenues, yeah, you could have easily done a $100 million round or $200 million round at a billion-dollar valuation, right? Like, so...
Right.
I mean, is that am I throwing out
no
realistic numbers, or
no? You are throwing out realistic numbers, and those are numbers that we very easily could have raised. And actually, it was one of the difficulties in why we were struggling to raise capital, because venture capitalists and PE wanted to put more money in. They wanted to own more of our business.
$25 million is nothing for what would they get, like 3% of
single digits. And so, this is just the nature of how we built our company. We only do what we need to do, like. If we need money,
super frugal.
We're very frugal, penny pinching, and that's like key to building a profitable, successful business, is being very aware of how you spend every penny.
So, how do you go from those conversations where they want to throw more money at you to doing a merger?
We just weren't okay. So then, what happened was, so we have VCs as one group. We had private equity, which was another group, and then we had.
Competitors.
We had competitors and what's the strategics?
Okay.
So like manufacturers.
Right.
And that was one. So what we did was like, all right, so we have all these other options. We didn't intend to look at these other kinds of things. We wanted just $25 million, but now we have a massive company everybody knows who threw down a number that was like, you've got to be kidding me. Seriously? We could do a full acquisition. We have a Chinese billionaire who said, I want 49%. You can keep control. You choose your valuation. Seriously.
Wow.
Seriously. We had some competitors that that are in our market who were like, let's work together and take on the big guys. And so we wanted to not be ignorant or I would say belligerent about our decision-making process. So we wanted to just see, okay, let's just entertain all of it and then we could sit down and make a decision as founders. And then we brought in our advisors and our mentors to make that decision. So we ended up with, there was a conversation with Advent, who is the owner of Certasimmons, the majority owner. And it was a great conversation because they reached out to us, the private equity firm that owns Certasimmons, and they posed this challenge that Certasimmons has, where they had done an acquisition, merged Certa and Simmons is also the parent of Beautyrest, in 2012 with the hopes to then take it public later by finding synergies. And like they bought it off the public market, put the companies together and want to take it public. They did that in 2011 and 12. But in 2012 is when Tufted Needle started. And then 2014 is when Casper and then Purple. And they didn't see this disruption coming, which is posing a threat to their growth.
Right.
And so their goal was to build a great company and a great brand and to eventually go back to potentially being public. I mean, you don't know what the plans are, but that was their intention, you know, and how and what was communicated when we first met them. But and what our goal was, and they were also facing this challenge of being disrupted and having to figure out this D2C thing and consumers and product development stuff. So they really wanted to build their brands like Tufted Needle and what we had, the quality. They had the quantity. We had the quality. We wanted to be their size.
Right.
And our goal was to build, to disrupt the industry, which we did, but also to build a company that was truly customer-centric and to set the standard for all others. So we needed to be very influential. So we wanted to scale up and to maintain scale that quality and customer experience the whole way. So when we were talking with them, the idea was we would receive all the funding we needed to expand our retail and to do this out-of-home marketing. So we'd be able to accelerate. And then they had the skeleton key to unlock all the retailers because they have relationships with everybody. So Tufted Needle could just snap our fingers, and bam, we can be in all retail stores. Also, we had a massive war chest with them to be able to scale up our profitable marketing that we were doing and out-of-home stuff. And then at the same time, it's a different mindset. It seems counterintuitive, but if our goal is to make the industry customer first, if we can accelerate the growth of Tufted Needle, but also take everything we've learned and help to apply it to Certa, Simmons, and Beautyrest, sort of disrupting at scale from the inside, we would say we're pirates raiding the ship, taking over the ship, which
right.
is very much what has happened even post-merger. This would help us actually accomplish our goal in the end. It may not be just Tufted Needle. It may be Tufted Needle and some other brands, but we've actually would essentially set the standard much faster, and it would also de-risk a lot of our future worries in case, you know, something really bad happened to us because we were always cash poor. But anyway, so that was really the reason why we gravitated towards this concept. And we wouldn't do it unless it was a merger, like operationally, legally, and financially. So we wanted our team to have a massive influence and to be fully integrated and have some control over how that company would operate and how it would transform.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And that's why you call it a merger, because you guys didn't cash out, essentially. You're part owners of the it's so hard for me to say their name for whatever reason, Certasimmons. You're part owner of Certasimmons as a result of the merger.
Yes.
Okay. And you guys stuck around. I mean, like 2 years later, you're still actively helping run the company, right?
Exactly. So that's why I tell people like, we didn't exit. That wasn't the exit.
Some chips off the table, I presume, right?
We did.
Okay.
Yeah. So that was part of the deal, and it was less about us and it was more about our team, because some of our team members have been here since the beginning. And we wanted to, show good goodwill, and like we, you know. that we are in here for the right thing and we really care about our team members. So it was, we did negotiate some chips that were taken off the table, but the vast majority of the value was rolled into the stock. Dahee and I are the largest individual owners of the whole company. We have a non-voting board seat, and you know, I have an executive role and play a very important part of the company. I'm the chief disruption officer. We wouldn't have done it either, like, any other way. If we were going to do a deal at all, which we didn't need to do, and also in hindsight, we definitely didn't need to do. We could have continued to bootstrap, but it may have been even better for us. But either way, it was a great story. You've got the original, the pioneer and the disruptor merging with the largest mattress company in the world, who's losing their foothold and they're starting to shrink, and it's going to be this turnaround. They attempted to start their own D2C brand, but it was a flop. And now you get the original, you put them together, and then you both teams learn. Tough Needle learns how to scale and go into retail, and then Serta Simmons learns how to develop product for consumers, not just retailers, how to slim down their 3,000 models down to maybe 10 or so, and iterate and market and all of these things. The manufacturer going direct to the consumer. And also, it was a big challenge to convince the retailers that it was actually better for them to allow this brand, these brands, to go direct and sort of compete, to allow them to really build demand for their brand and also iterate their products and make better products.
So, this might be a line of thinking or questions that you might not be able to answer, so you might want to blink a couple of times depending on the answer. But it seems to me that a traditional company that has been established so and entrenched in the ways in which they've been doing things for decades is going to have a hard time all of a sudden becoming, like, adopting your culture and your sort of, like, pace of development to be an essentially e-commerce company overnight, right? Like, and that's sort of like the direction that they would have to go in order to be a viable future company. Mm-hmm. An e-commerce company that happens to have some retail presence and, you know, does some retail really well. In the same way that, for example, Amazon is getting into retail all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. Are you finding that challenge to be something that, you know, Serta Simmons is well positioned to, you know, like, overcome? Or like, are you finding it that, like, wow, it is difficult for them to be able to shift over that challenge or, like, get over that hump? And there's a lot of culture clash, right? Like, I mean, I would presume that there would be a lot of culture clash in that sense.
Yeah. And I would say some parts of Serta Simmons, Serta Simmons today is very different than it was when we first did the deal. But some of the things we thought would be really hard were a lot easier. So some aspects of how the dynamics between the teams worked and the, like, integration, as they call it, worked, was a lot easier than we had anticipated. And some was harder.
Okay.
And there still is struggle today because you have overlap between two teams, and you've got a manufacturer with a sales team, and then you've got a product development company who does marketing and has a relationship and experience with the consumer
directly,
who's, you know, and so we're going, Tough Needle was going agnostic to channels, and Serta Simmons really wasn't in channels. They were just selling to retailers mostly. And so you're having Serta Simmons become more like Tough Needle. I would say, and this is something that's always been a challenge for me and our team, but especially for me and Dahee, you have a lot of people within Serta Simmons who feel threatened. I think that's fair because a lot of what they're doing will be deprecated over time, as it naturally would. As an example, like, you don't need servers to run your email anymore. I mean, this is a very small, specific example where you don't need this team. And so, you know, they have a team that needs to move to be more cloud-based and more, you know, DevOps-based as opposed to more IT-based. That's a small example of, we have a team that does sort of everything in the cloud, like an IT team of two people.
Right.
And who manages
all
of our
data. And
they
have multiple people who just manage Exchange Server or something.
right. And so that's an example, you know, or, you know, you've got you know, no customer service team, and you've got a massive customer service team, and this customer service team is doing customer service for retailers, and this customer service team is much, much bigger and is managing for consumers. And so, you know, does the customer service team over here expand to consumers? Like, do they start to report to us? And so there's some scenarios where, you know, some of the roles are just not just one's going to move to one side or the other, but where there will be a deprecation of like what the competencies are that the future company has.
What, just out of curiosity, why are you still there? Like, I mean, and I don't mean that in a negative way in any way, but like when it's your company, there's sort of like you have relative full control, or between the two of you, you have relative full control and you can do anything, and you're sort of like marching with a particular goal that you set out to. But at some point, do those challenges become like, okay, like I've already done my thing. Is it time to go do my next thing, or you know, whatever? Like, does that thought cross your mind on a regular basis? Or
it definitely does. It definitely does, and I think that that's normal, you know, for a founder that goes through what I've gone through. Dahi's left. He left within the first year.
Okay.
It was really hard. It was really, really hard, and a lot of different style of work than we were accustomed to. It wasn't so much, we both are very adaptable and able to have a, you know, like report to a CEO of a different company. We can do that. We maintained control and CEO of Tough the Needle, but then we also had this other company that we had to report to. So, but it wasn't so much that as it was the difficulty of the transformation and educating and the slowness of speed. And it was very challenging at first. And so he felt that it was just not for him anymore. I do wrestle with this, and I really want to see us cross that finish line. I don't know if I'll go all the way there. So it's been about 3 years or so since we did the merger. There's nothing like legally binding me. There's no financial incentive for me anymore. I've already crossed that. So I'm really here to support the team, and I really want to continue to help. I want to be proud of the brand in 10 years. And I want to make sure it's got a good footing.
It's still your baby, right? Like it's the way you're seeing it is that, you know, you've made your mark. You've solved this problem for the real problem that you talked about at the beginning. You have to solve a real problem.
Yeah.
And you've solved it at scale, and it has an opportunity to scale even further. And you want to sort of, your motivation is to see it through a little bit further than.
I want to do anything I can to preserve like the core tenets and the guidelines, like the experience of Tough the Needle for our customers. So I don't want to regret having left too soon for the sake of, you know, busting what we've built and spent so much time on, so like much blood, sweat, and tears. Not just with the founders, but like we have a lot of friends who work at Tough the Needle, or, you know, even if people who've moved on have like invested a lot of their time and their life into this brand. And we even have family who's in the company, and just tons of team members who are like, you know, very passionate about what we set out to do. And so for me, I feel an obligation to do as best as I can to get us there, and to be at least, you know, there for the team, even if it's just side by side with them, as opposed to like running in front of the line into battle. So that's one aspect. Also, you know, I also feel an obligation to, you know, when we did the merger and the deal with Advent, we had agreed on what we were going to do. And so I do want to follow through on that. But as far as like moving on, like I do intend to, and I have a lot of ideas and things that I really want to explore and test
for my next. Speaking of that, that's actually one of the things I wanted to ask you. If you weren't doing Tough the Needle, what would you be doing?
Well, I would say like when I started Tough the Needle, I fully sacrificed all of my hobbies and all of my free time. And now I regret that a bit. And so I would say about 2 years ago, I decided that I wasn't going to work on weekends anymore, and I was going to call it around 5 or 6 o'clock at night. And so I had all this extra free time to start picking up hobbies again. But I really cycle. I like when I get burnt out on something, I'll move on to something new, and then I might come back to something I've been into. But right now, the big thing for me is skydiving.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you enjoying skydiving?
Yes.
Yeah. And like, are you going frequently, or like, have you just done it a few times, or like, are you doing it on a regular basis?
On a regular basis.
Okay.
Yeah. So I attempted to work towards my license last year before COVID. COVID hit, and so I wasn't able to finish my license, the schooling. But in January this year, I'm like, right, it's going to happen. And you know, it's one of those things that I've always. In a sense, envied a little bit, or really wanted to experience. Like I feel it like in my heart, like it's something I really want to do. And yeah. My brain's like, this is a terrible idea. And there's like, it's sort of really dangerous. And, you know, I had a lot of fear, but I felt like I owed it to myself to do this, or I'm going to regret it when I'm older. I also got to learn that, you know, there are people who are in their 70s who are like really great skydivers. But you have to sort of start a little when you're younger. So right. You learn the skill. So when you're older, you can land gracefully and not have, you know, collisions.
Break your legs.
Right.
Do you do the, what is this, the wingsuit things too? Or is that not?
I'm not there yet.
Okay.
No, but that is something I want to learn. So it's about 200 jumps before you can
do wingsuits.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And wingsuits are really formalizing. So it used to be sort of like a underground sort of like make your own suit, or that, you know, like then a company started making them, and now there's more rules around it. So if you're going to go up in a plane with a suit, you have to have like a special license for it. But yeah, so I go every few weeks. I'm not like an every weeker kind of skydiver, but, and when you go up, you jump like, you know, I jump like 5 or 6 times.
Where do you go to Eloy?
Yeah. It's like the Mecca. It's like one of the biggest and hottest spots, you know,
in the country, right? Like it's kind of
in the world.
Oh wow.
Yeah, it's one. I think it is the most active skydiving spot in the world.
Wow.
Just 40 minutes south of Phoenix.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Now, when we were talking offline about hobbies, you mentioned another hobby, which we have to talk about, psychedelics.
Yeah.
Right. So tell me about that. Like,
well, honestly, so it peaked, my interest was peaked. My brother-in-law had been talking. He's like, you would be really into this. You'd be really into this. I'm like, I'm never going to do it. Like, it's not going to happen. And then it just the opportunity came about, and I had that opportunity to try mushrooms, and it wasn't what I thought it was. It was an incredible experience. And I also went through some struggles as a founder, especially like pre-merger and post-merger. And it really became something that was sort of therapeutic to help me work through my mindset. And so, yeah, that then turned into like a hobby of exploration and psychonautics, where I would explore many different types of psychedelics and was seeking different mental states and states of consciousness, and you know, and helping educate people who are interested in it and like how to approach it and all of that, almost like sort of very informal shamaning. But yeah, that was something that I had gotten into, and I have just as much passion. I have more passion now than I did when I started. So it's not something it's really getting old for me.
What you just said, we're going to have to like dive deep into now, because we could almost start the podcast over again at this point, because holy cow. First of all, you just recently got into it in the past 3-4 years or?
Yeah, about 3.5 years.
Okay. So I know nothing about it. Right. So you got to educate me from like the ground up. What is the experience like? What is like, what attracted you to it after you did it first time? Like, what was it like in terms of what you thought it would be versus what it actually was? And how is it helping you? Like,
well, I think as far as what I thought it was, I wasn't sure, sort of the fear of the unknown. And my first experience was a very small amount of mushrooms. A good friend, trusted friend, gave me some, and I'm like, I'm not doing that much. So I did a very small amount. And it was, I felt a lot of joy and felt like euphoria.
And these are mushrooms, you just eat them?
You just eat them.
You just eat them, yeah. And then all of a sudden.
Well, so there's many different psychedelics, different categories, and there's many different ways that you can also use them. Different techniques. You can use them very recreationally. You can use them more therapeutically or formally in a more therapeutic setting. And, you know, as far as how you can eat mushrooms, you can encapsulate them. There's many different ways. You know, there's tinctures where it's like a liquid psilocybin that you put under your tongue. There's many ways, and then there's many other psychedelics. Like my most recent experiences with ayahuasca, we were talking about Costa Rica, and that's actually why I was there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So as far as the experience for me, that my first time, I would say it was very light. It was very euphoric. I sort of dove into my mind and started reliving some of my past. And I really felt like I was able to self-therapy myself and talk through, and I was able to I'm not naturally very good, like socially. I'm very introverted. And some of the conflicts in my life that I was struggling with, that was very topical at the time, I was able to think about them and then better understand why they were happening. And also, I would, in those moments in my experience, I would have a lot more empathy with the person. You know, I'm not with them, I'm on mushrooms, but right. I'm thinking more empathetically about them and from their point of view, which then in turn, I ended up doing mushrooms more and more. And then in turn, started changing the way I think about my interactions with people. So instead of getting there was a time where I was a very more of a defensive person. So when somebody would challenge an idea of mine, for the most part, I'm great with. But there were times where if I was very, very passionate about it, I would get very defensive. Or if people were, you know, critical of, you know, a way of going about a particular project or something like that, I would get defensive. And it just shut that off. And I very rarely get defensive at all anymore. I just think totally different about it. Also, the love I have for others, I'm not very good at expressing my love for other people. And I'm not just talking about, like, you know, family. I'm talking about, like, friends and even strangers and really loving other people. I didn't really get that and what that was. But now I, like, really have a genuine love for other people. And the people, even people that, like, I have problems with or had problems with, I genuinely do love them now. And it's just changed my attitude totally and my behavior around them. And I actually thought that, you know, this particular change in my personality, as I'm, like, telling people, I started telling all of my friends that I love them. And even people that are, you know, not to freak them out, but like people that aren't like close friends, but are kind of more on the acquaintance side, but still friends. I thought I would come off too overbearing, and I was totally surprised. I think because it's very genuine. Almost everybody tells me they love me too. And I'm like, this is really weird. I'm sort of like coming up to.
It is nice to hear someone say, I love you. Right. Like it's especially men don't tell each other as much that they love each other. Like and it's nice to hear it every now and then.
And I think it's
surprising that others, we don't do it more often.
And it's like we need it.
Yeah.
And we need it from like other men too, or, you know, like, and I feel like what it's done is and where I am today as after 3.5 years, and I've gone on a deep, deep dive on many different things. And as far as the frequency of my exploration, it's like very frequent. And I'm just fascinated by the magic of seeing the world in a different way or seeing other dimensions. I didn't even believe that there were other dimensions, and now I 100% do, with zero doubt. But like,
that's incredible.
But what's happened, where I am now, is I really don't have many negative or critical thoughts anymore. I don't really get frustrated. I feel happy all the time. And I feel like that's really brought a lot of joy, not just to me, but it also has been very influential to those people I spend a lot of time with, and it's infectious. So it's infecting the people around me. I wish I had done this more before, like, and got to the point I'm at now before the merger and before COVID and all that, so I could have been this sort of person or in this phase of my life and my personality for my team. And one of my biggest regrets is not telling my team how much I love them or thanking them or telling them how proud I am, because I just didn't stop to say that. We celebrate. I'm so thankful that we would celebrate success, but I never really communicated my appreciation as much as I now wish I had. But I'm doing it now. I'm doing it now, especially with my family and friends and the people I come in contact with. But anyways, to kind of sum up like the, your question, that's really what it's been like for me.
It's such an interesting topic because, you know, Steve Jobs is fairly famous for having experimented with psychedelics. And at some point, he shut off talking about it externally. But a lot of people were encouraging him to talk about it, and he never did. But there is some, like, aspect of psychedelics that became, like, a no-no to talk about or became sort of, like, seen as a negative, which dates back to the 60s. I don't know much about it, but I suspect somebody like you who is now actively doing it and has researched it to some degree can maybe shed some light for people like me, honestly, because I'm curious about the subject more so than, you know, I'm wondering what is it about psychedelics in particular that makes people more creative or see things in a different light that they wouldn't otherwise see. In some ways, it seems to rewire their brains to see things before other people can see them, right?
And it really depends on the person and how what you're doing and where you're at with the stage. It's your journey. If you are on a journey to explore your mind and explore the universe, using a tool that a perception tool like a psychedelic or a medicinal plant, everybody's experience is unique. And if you're on this journey, there are many things that it can do for you, like being able to kind of see ahead and see things that others maybe who aren't on this kind of a journey would. But it's different for everybody. There's a lot of similarities though. But yeah, I think so. I'm still researching and reading. Now I'm reading more about the history. So I'm like in the middle of exploring exactly the question you ask. But from my understanding, psychedelics were viewed as almost like a counter movement to like war and violence and questioning authority. And it was viewed as a threat. And you have there were figureheads. At the time, I'm being very vague because I don't feel that I'm as educated on the fine detail to talk about it. Maybe next time. But you have these figureheads that who are like very influential in these people who are exploring psychedelics back in the 60s and 70s, and would talk about like love and talk about anti-violence, and it was really perceived from. You know, one particular party that was feeling threatened was the government. And so that then turned into government policy starting to be enacted because, you know, the theory is that it's really being driven by the fear of this changing mental state that society is going through. And so it was being spun that it was damaging your brain or it's like frying your brain or it causes psychosis or long-term psychosis and other long-term effects. And you see then sort of spin in the media and then which then became sort of mass perception in our society, and it's evil and it's bad. And we just and it was really unfortunate because psychiatrists, psychologists, and researchers were really making a lot of ground and understanding what is happening, what it's doing in our brain, and how it can be used not just for therapeutic, I mean, primarily, I think, for therapeutic reasons and purposes and healing, but also exploring and to better understand our universe and from a different, not just the matter of our universe, but.
And most of that research stopped, essentially, right?
It was banned, essentially, And so MAPS and other organizations and individuals have made some serious progress in helping to unlock. You know, and legalize research. So there's a path you can take to become permitted to do research on psychedelics and to experiment. And the universities who once at one point would sort of ban or like, you know, push you out of the academic scene because you're linked somehow to psychedelics is now in the switched where it's now the new hot subject to research and which university is going to be in the lead and which different psychedelic compound or drug or, you know, plant medicine are you going to figure out and develop a new form of and new therapeutic.
You're saying
process.
It's coming back then?
Huge.
Oh, that's
yeah. There
that's
is
awesome.
Actually legislation in California. I think it was announced yesterday. That isn't. It just passed its first critical step. It needs like one or two more steps to fully legalize all psychedelics: LSD, psilocybin, psilocin, MDMA, ketamine, and there's probably another one I'm not thinking of, to fully legalize it. So you can have it on your person, you can give it to others as long as you're over the age of 21. Schools are no longer, from what I remember, allowed to talk about them being dangerous or illegal. And research on future and other psychedelic compounds is being fully unlocked for research centers and that are licensed. So it's like California is about to, assuming it fully passes, which it just passed one of the most difficult stages for the legislation process, to fully legalize psychedelics, the majority of them.
Huh. That seems like a great way to actually start real research in terms of like what is working, what is not, and like the potential usage for it.
Yeah,
so
that's
great to hear.
There has been a lot of research at the different universities, and the FDA has been even accelerating some of their process to help get some of these therapeutics through. Like ketamine is one that's newly sort of like approved and allowed to be used in therapeutic doses for licensed centers or IV centers that are licensed to do it and administer it. It has been picking up steam, and you've got big companies or psychedelic companies and research companies that have been going public. And so it's so strange to see these psychedelic companies on the public markets.
Wow.
Yet it's illegal. So it's like to give you a leading indicator or a bellwether of where things are going. In California, if this is passed, that will then become a indication of how things go. Like, so it's sort of like the state that took the first step. So other,
right.
You know, just like we saw with marijuana, the other states can observe how this goes to give them some guidance on how to execute their own policy changes.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
One other topic I want to talk to you about, which is that when you guys set out to build Tuft & Needle, one of your criterias was to solve a real problem.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys worked at a company where you felt like it wasn't solving a real problem, right? Like I think I saw a video on your website where, like maybe it was like Tinder for cats or something.
Yeah.
Like you weren't working on that necessarily, but it was sort of implying that there's a lot of stupid shit that's being worked on out there.
Yeah,
and
a lot.
What are your thoughts about where the brain power of the world that we live in is going into? And there's a huge amount of concentrated brain power on social media right now, and other sort of like get rich quick type of software products that might not have meaning from a solving a real problem sort of way. We were talking about games that offer dances inside them, right? Like the dances take tremendous amount of technology to perfect and create these amazing lifelike dances, which you're having like mathematicians and physicists and such to work on and computer scientists to work on in order to like sell a $5 dance in a video game, right? Like, so it's sucking a lot of that brain power. What are your thoughts on, about where we are today?
So I'm immensely frustrated with my experience in Silicon Valley. So I've, as a kid, my father would tell me stories about early Silicon Valley companies and, the battle between Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and how, the dynamics and that, and then like the innovations. And I've always wanted to go to Silicon Valley and to experience what I was hearing in the stories. When I got to Silicon Valley, it wasn't really what I thought. And I think it was really the period of time I was there. This is a time when Pinterest was really hot, and that was like the top startup it was a very exciting time for those types of applications. But to kind of paint the picture of what I was seeing was there definitely are companies innovating and doing really good work, but the vast majority of them felt like let's say Pinterest is the hot company in the news. You see just hundreds of Pinterest, like Pinterest this, Pinterest that, Pinterest with this feature, Pinterest without this feature, all of these sort of fragmented or derivatives of whatever is hot. And so it's a lot of it seems to be there are people who are, I've heard this idea of playing house. They want to be a founder, and they want to play house and start something. And rather than looking for some problem or something that could really be made better, they're focusing on what's really hot and trending, and let's go and do that and make the, you know, sort of a get rich quick pump and dump approach to valuation. And that's why we never really cared about our valuation of our company. We wanted to just build a good business, and it, wherever it lands, that's fine for us. So that's always been very frustrating. The social media thing, I'm off social completely. So, you know, I had gotten off of Facebook and then Instagram and Snapchat, and I'm fully disconnected.
It's really good discipline.
The only social I use is Reddit, and I'm very careful, and I have some sort of principles in how I choose which subs I follow. For me, it needs to be very educational. And I continue to read Hacker News, which is a bit social. Those are the two primary things I read, and when I'm like burning time. But I feel like there's enough value for me that I can justify doing that in limited doses. But as far as social media, I feel like that as humans, we really, there's two things we really need amongst many others, but like two primary, almost conflicting needs we have. One is we need to express ourselves, and we also need to connect with others. And in my experiences, when I was young, I struggled with expression because I feared judgment and the critics of my peers. And so that was something that I suppressed in favor of connection. And it's something I sort of lost. And as an adult, I'm working to bring back and starting to express myself more. Like, not necessarily these things for me, but like just creating and making. And, you know, if you're a painter or dancing and singing and whatever. And I feel that what social media is doing is it's creating a form of expression, but I don't feel like it's true expression for yourself because it's being passed through this filter of what will people think about this. So it almost right. like goes down this, and I was talking about mycology. I got into mycology. If I was caring about what other people were going to think of me or like, would this be photogenic for me to share, I wouldn't have chosen mycology. But I'm doing myself a disservice because it was something that was really interesting to me and I really wanted to learn, but it was something that might bore somebody else. And so I see so many people and it's sort of like, it breaks my heart a bit, especially, you know, family or friends who I know they're choosing things in their life, you know, their hobbies or interests purely based off of what they think others will think about it. And they're being driven by this perception of what others think of you. So, you know, so that from that aspect of social, I don't really care for social media that much. But then now you have social media companies with these massive valuations, and it's something that everybody uses, and it's really driving a trend of social media applications. And I don't know. I don't like, there are innovations to be had, and it may be good and have byproduct for like other markets and other products and whatever in other industries. But I don't see as much value in those types of innovations as other problems that we are experiencing as humans in this human experience. So,
yeah.
Or maybe in psychedelic research as an example,
yeah.
I feel would be, there would be more benefits to society to helping to unlock those, like that magic and those secrets of the universe and these tools and, you know, and helping people become more exposed to them, I think would be much more profoundly impactful to society than developing the next social media app for cats.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Very well said. What brought you to Arizona, by the way, just out of curiosity? Because I realized when yeah. you started, like Tuft & Needle, you were still in Silicon Valley. And, yeah. I can't believe I didn't connect that to Arizona yet. Like, but when you were just telling the story of wanting to be in Silicon Valley, like what brought you back? Or not back, but what brought you to Arizona in the first place?
It started with, so we had some issues while we were, so over the summer of 2012, I would say even into 2013, because I kept my apartment out there, Dahi and I had a bet. So we wanted to, what was happening was we were struggling, one, to find office space we could afford, and two, to be able to find talent and in Silicon Valley. Mm. And it was sort of like this, issue of when we would find somebody really good, they either had golden handcuffs at a big company, getting paid really well with incredible benefits and whatever, working on really crazy cool projects, or they were co-founders in their own little tiny startup. It was like one or the other.
Right.
And try to convince somebody before the mattress market had been disrupted and people are like, oh, this is kind of like tech too. And it became sexy and cool, more sexy and cool than it was. I wouldn't necessarily say it's like that sexy and cool as it is. But try convincing somebody to join like a mattress company, especially one that's not planning to raise money. So that was one reason. Was it was difficult to find talent who was interested to join us. It was expensive to we knew it was going to be very expensive to pay rent. We didn't want to hire. There's this mercenary mentality where people will work for you for like a year and then bail. Cross their equity cliff.
To the next startup.
We didn't want people like that. We wanted people who'd bet long term. And then also for ourselves, like our cost of lifestyle, we needed to cut. So we needed to move or raise capital.
Why Arizona or why Phoenix?
So we were looking at, we were looking at Denver, we were looking at Vegas, Austin, and Phoenix. And Phoenix was one that we really hadn't heard much about. And I have family here. I have a relative here, and so does Dahi. We both had ties here. When we were investigating and looking into Phoenix, we sort of fell in love with it because it's warm. The weather is very consistent. There is a little tech scene here. Yeah. We didn't realize this, and there's a lot that we realized after we moved here. But another one was noise. So in the media. So we wanted the ability to be able to get noticed in media. And maybe that, you know, there will be a point in Phoenix where there's too much noise. But we wanted to be able to become noticed in the news.
Yeah. And it's easier to be a bigger fish in a smaller pond. That's awesome. What's funny about you and Dahi is that, like, you guys created criterias to build Tufted Needle, created criterias to, like, what city are we going to move to? And it's such a great way to evaluate things. And that bringing you guys to Phoenix just goes to show that, like, Phoenix has a lot going for it. You know, like it beat out Denver and Vegas and other places. It's so great.
Yeah,
it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the podcast and being able to talk through Tufted Needle and sharing your experiences with not only that, but even psychedelics and anything else you want to talk about before we wrap up?
But that's it.
Yeah, I mean, thank you.
I mean, we can keep going.
I'm sure. But no, we'll have to have you back. It's been so fascinating. And wow, you're like totally intriguing, causing my brain to think about all kinds of things that I'm going to want to talk to you about further down the road. So
right on.
Thank you again, JT. Appreciate it. All right, you made it to the end of the episode. I would love to get your feedback, so take a moment to leave a genuine review in your favorite podcast app. That also helps us reach more people. Speaking of reach, if you like a particular episode, be sure to share it with someone who you think would enjoy it. See you next time.
Thanks for watching the AZ Tech Show with Hamid Shojaei. Each week, we'll feature some of our favorite moments from our AZ Tech podcast interviews. You can watch the full interviews on our AZ Tech Podcast YouTube channel or listen to the AZ Tech Podcast in your favorite podcast app. You can also go to aztechpodcast.com for more information. Follow us on Twitter at AZ Tech Podcast to stay up to date with our latest episodes. AZ Tech Show is produced by Hamid Shojaei and Adrian St. Clair. Our intern is Abby Sharp. See you next week.